Am I working? Can't see anyone nodding. I'm reassured now. Very, very cool chorus, that last one. If I was more confident that I was going to speak to time, I'd read through the whole of it again with you. Says things an awful lot better than I feel I'm about to say things. I like the words of it a lot. A couple of things, first of all, before we get going. The length of the sermon. The last time I spoke, I was about 10, 15 minutes too short. I now appreciate what terrible trouble that causes when you speak for too short. I want you to know I've learnt from my lesson, and there is no danger this morning of it happening again. Another thing. That wasn't supposed to happen. It's got a mind of its own, Peter. Is it just going to flick through the sides if I don't do anything? I hope you weren't reading those, because we haven't got there yet. People have all sorts of opinions on Hebron and what needs to change here and what would be better. Some people feel, you know, the worship could change in this way, or the teaching could change in that way, or the leadership could change in this way. I have some sympathy, you know, with all of those positions. But my personal feeling is what Hebron really needs most is some more sermons on mathematics. And I am a maths teacher. I often see Rachel at Newton Rig, which is where I teach. And so, quite a lot of maths in this morning's sermon. I recognize there's the possibility I will be the only person who's really excited by it and enjoying it. But I live with that every day of my life, so I can live with it on a Sunday as well, I hope. The Apostles' Creed, which we started looking at last week. It is some sort of attempt, like all creeds are, to state a bottom line. To say, this really is non-negotiable. Other stuff might be up for grabs, but this isn't. It's an attempt to say things like, to be a Christian, you really, really ought to believe this. Or, practically more frequently, to be a member of a particular church, you really need to believe this. It's an attempt to separate between those issues where you would expect to agree with anyone who is born again of the Spirit of God, and those issues where you may well expect to disagree with anyone who is born again. Last week, we looked at I believe in God, the Father Almighty. This week, we're looking at God, the Creator of heaven and earth. Now, the first half of this sermon has quite a lot of words in it. The second half has quite a lot of pictures in it. I intend getting through the first half as quickly as possible, because I like the second half better. And I feel there is every chance you will too. Now, first of all, when it comes to creation, three big things we agree about as Christians. Probably. You say you agree about anything with any group of Christians, and you feel you're just taking such a foolish risk. But I feel there's an outside chance that we probably agree on some things. Number one, God created everything. So that means all the physical stuff, things like stars and planets, rock, water, little things like atoms and electrons and quarks. The Higgs boson, which has been in the news recently, don't know if it exists yet. If it does exist, God created it. If it doesn't, then he probably didn't. God created time. God created space. And God created more amorphous things, the laws of nature, the laws that nature obeys, things like gravity, electromagnetism, and very, very strange things. You name it, if it's out there, God created it. And talking about Jesus' role in creation, John says, through him all things were made, without him nothing was made that has been made. So that's the first thing. God created everything. Number two, there are no limits on how long God could have chosen to take. And to the best of my knowledge, Christians agree that God really is that powerful. If he wanted to make the universe in 6 days, he was perfectly able to. If he wanted to make it in 6 seconds, he was perfectly able to. If he wanted to make it in 15 billion years, feels like a long time to me, but he was perfectly able to. I'm not aware of any serious argument amongst Christians about God's ability. God's ability to do whatever he wanted to do, and to follow that through. Number three, Christians also agree that at the very heart of creation, God had one very special project. God created absolutely everything, as we've been saying, but one thing stands completely alone for very special mention in the Bible. Let us create man in our image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. We'll come back to that. Just when you think there's no limit to the number of things we can agree about, two big things that Christians disagree about. First of all, and this is probably the trickiest of them, Christians do disagree about what is the right way to understand the Bible. And I'm talking here about Christians who have complete confidence in the Bible, complete confidence in it as the Word of God, inspired by God, all of it. Those are the sort of Christians I'm talking about. Which bits of the Bible should be read as literal history, in exactly the same way that we would all read about the crucifixion of Jesus? Which bits should be read as more poetic, more allegorical, more metaphorical, more like we would read the book of Revelation? Not going into any detail on that. Christians disagree on that matter. When it comes to creation, they also disagree as to what is the right way to understand the scientific evidence. If you look at the scientific evidence in isolation from the Bible, what does it seem to imply? Christians are not of one mind when it comes to that. The things that you're more likely to be familiar with, I say secondary things not because they're small, they're still big things in all honesty, they're just not quite as big as the other two things, but three secondary things that Christians disagree about. How long ago did creation take place? The two most popular alternatives are not desperately close to each other. About 6,000 years ago, about 15 billion years ago. Christians disagree on that. They disagree about how long the process took, and that's really the process from when God kick-started things to the moment when man had been created. How long did that part of the process take? And again, about 6 days, about 15 billion years again. Christians disagree on that. How did he do it? How did God create everything? How did God create us? Now, loosely speaking, I remember Tim Proudlove speaking on this a number of years back, and I think he fairly well explained that broadly speaking there are three positions that Bible-believing Christians hold to. The first one is that very much as you read it in Genesis 1, read it fairly literally, that it took 6 days. You have individual creative acts by God. One day he creates this, the next day he creates that, third day he creates this. So you have God very intimately involved in individual acts of creation for individual things like the sky, the sea, the different animals, man, and so on. At the other end of the spectrum, you have those who see God's big involvement as being right at the very, very beginning. And one of the things that he created was a process. And he created a process whereby all the things he wanted to exist would then come into existence. Not dissimilar from when you sort of put all the ingredients together for a cake and you then pop it in the oven, and you can walk away and leave it if you want to. Come back an hour or two later and everything's happened that you always intended to happen. The cake is fully formed and ready to eat. Christians would believe something along those lines may have happened. Christians disagree. In recent years, a sort of third position has crept in, which I think is a sort of compromise between the two, which sees a long period of time. It sees the action of a process, but it sees a God who very positively, very deliberately intervenes at certain moments in order to push the sort of creative process forwards and bring certain things into existence. Those are the three positions. What about me, I hear you say? No, I didn't hear you say that, actually. The bad news is this. At various points in my life, I have now held all three of those positions. I haven't just held them, I have held them with passion. I have held them with ferocity. This creates a problem for me. I think the biggest problem it creates is that I now have the very, very worst of postmodern brains when it comes to this issue, which makes me feel like a disaster. But there is an upside, from a personal point of view. If, you know, you're really, really wanting someone to affirm the position you hold on creation, I am the man. And I probably know some arguments you're not aware of. So if you're wanting me to build you up and affirm you and say, you could easily be right, and did you know this as well, then I'm more than happy to oblige. However, if you're more of a sort of Peter Quant type character and you're looking for a bit of an argument, I can do that too. So if you're wanting someone to tell you that your position is ridiculous and completely foolish and it's beyond belief that you hold it, quite happy to oblige. I can do that and hopefully provide some reasonable arguments along the way. None of that is very helpful to you, but I just thought I'd mention it. Yes, we are there. Coming back to less disagreeable territory. So coming back to the points at which we agree as Christians. God created everything. There are no limits on how he could have chosen to do it, and in particular on how long he could have chosen to take. At the very heart of creation, God had one very special project in mind. But number four is really where I'd like to concentrate for the rest of the morning. God's creation points towards its creator. God's creation points towards its creator. First from Romans. So Paul said, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." David, in Psalm 8, taking a few of the verses from Psalm 8, "Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." And the chorus that we were singing before, very much built around that. General revelation. Before we come to that, special revelation A loose definition of special revelation would be things that we can only know about God if he makes a special effort to communicate them to us. And this could be through angels, could be through prophets, could be through Jesus. For us, most of the time, what it really normally amounts to is the Bible. God's effort in having the Bible written so that we have very particular, very special knowledge, very special understanding, very special revelation as to his character, his nature, about us, his concerns about us, his relationship with us. That is special revelation. General revelation, again, probably includes more than this, but it's what I'm thinking about this morning. General revelation is something along the lines of what can we appreciate about God when we look at his creation. So without the Bible, without anything special, just looking at what God has done in creation, what can we appreciate about him? Things we can know about God without any extra special effort on his behalf. Normally this amounts to saying, if you want some insights into an artist, you may be able to gain some by looking at his art. If you want some insight into the creator of the heavens and the earth, you may be able to gain some by looking at his creation. Now, all sorts of people, depending on their background, have a way into this. Artists are an obvious group to start with. Artists often have a particular appreciation for the aesthetic beauty in God's creation, for the form, for the beauty they see. Physicists, this is really for Bruce's benefit and probably not anybody else's, have a particular appreciation of the significance of the fundamental constants of nature. What are those, I hear you ask? There are certain numbers, like the strength of gravity. And these numbers could be absolutely anything. They're totally arbitrary. They don't have to be what they are. They could be anything. But it turns out that they are exactly what is needed for it to be possible for life to exist in the universe. Imagine a lottery where to win you didn't have to choose 7 numbers correctly, but you had to guess 1,000,000 numbers correctly. Our universe has the winning lottery ticket. And physicists appreciate how surprising that is. Biologists have a particular appreciation for the complexity that we see in nature. And in recent years, a notion called irreducible complexity has come to life. An appreciation for the surprising complexity that lies behind the surface in living things. Irreducible complexity is an attempt to argue that the type of complexity you see in living things requires a creator to make it, that it would be impossible to have without a creator. Psychologists have a particular appreciation of the working of our moral compass. Well, I hope they do anyway. Our consciences. Our awareness of right and wrong. Our care. Our concern about what is right and what is wrong. Philosophers, that's what I aspire to be, have a particular appreciation of our ability to understand and appreciate the universe. This is surprisingly strong, but surprisingly hard to understand. Philosophers appreciate how surprising it is that we are able to understand and appreciate the universe as much as we are. You wouldn't expect it to be the case. There is the very, very strong feeling that the universe was made with us in mind, or that the universe was made for us. We could go on and on and on. You'll be glad to know that I don't. Chemists could look at things like water. Geographers, gardeners, I think, have a very particular appreciation of creation. Bird watchers, I don't see Barry this morning, or David. mountain walkers, parents. I think it really doesn't matter who you are, or what line of work you're in, or what your interests are. I think regardless, you really should have, possibly for very particular and personal reasons, a particular appreciation of God's creation. For many, there is the strong sense that there is a creative mind behind the universe, who is relational and moral. And possibly there are some further hints as to what he is like. Now, one group of people was missing from that list. What about mathematicians? Aside from a desire to make children suffer when they go to school, what can be said about them? And in particular, do they only like numbers and algebra and geometry and nonsense like that? Do they have any appreciation of God whatsoever? It's not a rhetorical question, you don't have to answer it. Mathematicians have a particular interest in shape, and have a quick look at how mathematicians understood the shape of nature before the 20th century. So mathematicians for a long time now, since the Greeks actually, they've been very comfortable with things like squares, circles, cylinders, cones, cubes, parallelograms, and all sorts of other jolly shapes with other really interesting names. And before the 20th century, mathematicians tended to ask, which of these shapes is a bit like something in nature? Because if we know which shape it's a bit like, maybe that'll help us to understand it a bit better and work with it a bit better. Now, I'll show you some shapes, but pre-20th century mathematician doesn't just see the shape, he sees something in nature. You have to guess what it is. Should be easy, I hope. That is a mountain. May look a bit like a cone, but the point is mountains are a bit like cones. Here is a wonderful mathematical drawing of, it is a human being, I'm sure you noticed it. It actually came from a delightful question that I stumbled on, which was all about how much toilet roll would you need to make someone into a mummy. And this was the diagram and the model to help you do that. So a good approximation from a human being in a mathematician's mind was, you know, a sphere on the top, four cylinders around the side, and a bigger cylinder in the middle. That is a flower. I didn't know that you did get triangular birds, but I discovered recently that apparently you do. Substantially more artistic, this one. That is a tree. A nice big green blobby bit on the top and a brown sort of longish bit at the bottom. Like you, I was thinking, I have never seen any trees that look desperately like that till I stumbled on this photo. Apparently, there are some. And one for Mike, if he was here this morning, what do you think this is? It's a cow. Yes, it's obvious when you know. Now, up until the 20th century, that really was all mathematicians had to work with when it came to trying to understand the shapes that we find in nature. Things like triangles, spheres, cylinders. At the end of the 19th century, a new type of shape was discovered. And they are called fractals. And they are a new type of shape. And they are breathtakingly different from any shape that mathematicians had ever bumped into before. They were very, very odd, quite wild and quite wacky. Now, it didn't cross the minds of any mathematician that there might be some useful and practical application for them, and that was because mathematicians just don't care about that sort of thing. But surprisingly, there was. Now, we're going to have a look at a shape in a moment, and it is strange. You need to understand it a little. This is where we're hitting the proper maths, by the way. It's a shape which has been coloured in. Now, to understand the colours, imagine, first of all, a circle where the inside of the circle has been coloured in black, and the outside of the circle has been coloured in blue. The shape you're going to look at is a bit like that. It is a shape where the inside has been coloured in black, and the outside has been coloured in blue. It is called the Mandelbrot set. It's a surprisingly easy to define shape, like a circle or a square. A computer program needs about 6 lines of programming, that's all. It's a tiny program. And it can draw this. It would take a very long time to draw it, but it can draw it. The inside of the shape is black. The outside of the shape is mostly blue. It is other colours as well, as you'll notice. Those other colours really just depend as you get closer to the edge of the shape. But basically, the inside's black and the outside is blue. That is its general shape. That is what the shape looks like. Some people think it's a bit like a sort of snowman or something turned on its side. And the inside of the shape has been coloured in black. The outside is other colours. Remember the general shape that you can see there? And then what we'll do is we'll have a look at some more detail at one bit of it. So that bit where the white rectangle is, we'll have a closer look at the detail of the shape at that point. Now, if you zoom in quite a lot, that's what you would see at that point. Lots more detail. If you zoom in on the white rectangle there, just to get a better view of that detail, that is what you see. Loads more detail. Loads more complexity. If we zoom in again, loads more detail. Loads more complexity. And surprisingly, down on the right-hand side there should be something that looks familiar. There should be a black, blobby little snowman sort of thing, which looks suspiciously similar to the original snowman. And suspiciously similar is exactly what it is. It's not the same. But it is very, very similar. If you look around it, you'll see there's actually loads of them. If you go up from it, down from it, there are lots of these little snowman-y things. None of them are the same, but they are all very similar. If we carry on in, there's more complexity, more detail. Let's carry on again, more complexity, more detail. If you're wondering what that little thing is in the middle of that rectangle, we'll find out soon enough. There it is again. What you're seeing there is called self-similarity. It's a property of fractals, where you see the original shape in tinier forms as you look inside it. Self-similarity. And we can keep going. And you keep going, and you keep going. There is more detail, more detail, more complexity, more complexity. At what point do you think you get to the end of the detail and the end of the complexity? Well, from the point of view of this morning, now, because that's the last slide that I've done on it. In reality, never. We could do 1,000,000 slides going in more and more detail. 1,000,000,000 slides looking in more and more detail. You never get past it. You never get beyond it. Fractals are profoundly strange shapes, profoundly surprising. One of the most surprising things about them is that fractals, unlike circles for people's heads, unlike triangles for strange-looking yellow birds, fractals are quite good pictures of the shapes that we do see in nature. In fact, the extraordinary thing about fractals is that if you choose the right one, it is breathtakingly similar to a part of nature. 3 properties of fractals found in nature. First one, self-similarity, that whole sort of business where you see the big thing and then you find the big thing in a smaller form buried inside, and then you find it in another smaller form buried inside again, and another smaller form. You meet that in nature surprisingly frequently. 3 examples of where nature has a fractal type structure. Ferns are very, very straightforward fractals. I should have brought one with me this morning. If you get a whole fern and then you take off one of the fronds and look at it, it is extremely similar to the whole thing, just smaller. If you then get one of the leaves off one of the fronds and take it off and look at it and look at its structure, it is very similar to the big thing. Go and pick one up sometime and start ripping it to pieces. And the little pieces are very, very similar in structure and shape to the big thing that it comes from. My favourite example of a fractal in nature used to live outside the staff room at Hebron School in India. And I used to steal them occasionally. I think there are still some left. I don't think I took all of them. But it's because they were such cool fractals. I found out their name yesterday for the first time. They're called Queen Anne's Lace, I believe. Anyone's met them? I think there's different flavours of Queen Anne's Lace. They look a bit like that. What I really liked about them is they have this really, really long stem that just goes up and up and up. Certainly the ones in India did. And then at the top of the stem, there's this great big explosion of life at the very top. And if you take a little bit of the explosion of life from the top and take it off and have a look at it, you realise that what it has is a really, really long stem that goes up and then this little explosion of life at the top of it. And if you take a flower off that and have a look at that, if you can do, what you see is it's got a really, really long stem and then a miniature explosion of life. It's a lovely fractal, lovely example of self-similarity. The human body has a problem, which is it likes to have blood everywhere. Blood has to get to every single, yeah, you'll correct me, every single cell in your body wants access to blood? Is that true or is that just nonsense? It's true-ish, she said. Keep it sort of more vague than what I said then. You've got to get blood absolutely jolly everywhere in the body. Now, that is quite tricky to do. The easiest way to do it would be if we were just a bag of blood and there was nothing else inside us at all. Then you would have blood everywhere. Now, for various reasons, that just wasn't practical, I think, for God. So he worked on a different system, which is the blood supply. The blood supply in our bodies is a very cool fractal. Coming from the heart, you have a very big artery that then branches off. Something which is similar to the original artery, just smaller. And then that branches off, and then that branches off, and then that branches off, down to smaller and smaller and smaller sizes. Till ultimately you have these tiny little sort of tubes going through your body, which allow eeny weeny bits of blood to get absolutely everywhere you need it. A fractal turned out to be God's solution for how to get blood everywhere without being a bag of blood. So there is self-similarity that we see in nature. The other thing, which is a property of fractals, is that you have an awful lot of complexity. You had a glimpse of the Mandelbrot set. Bizarre complexity in that case. Same is true in nature. You have an awful lot of complexity, but from relatively simple instructions. The instructions that seem to lie behind how we are made, you know, things like our DNA. The instructions are relatively simple, but they seem to create surprising complexity, surprising detail. This has been useful for people who work in the film industry, and in particular for people who work in the special effects industry. If you want to make something in a film that looks like a realistic landscape, or just a realistic natural thing, it can be tricky to do. Fractals have given filmmakers and special effects people a way into doing that. So if you have an alien planet and you want to have a completely convincing looking alien planet on the screen in front of someone, the easiest way to do that now is through programming, which is fractal programming. What the program does is draw fractals of things that look like real things. These next five or six pictures, six of them, none of these are photographs. These are just mathematical shapes drawn on a computer with I don't know how many lines of programming in these cases. That is not a real cloud. That's a computer-generated image using a piece of programming built around fractals so that it looks like a cloud. That is not sand on the seashore. It is a fractal. It's just a mathematical shape drawn on a computer. That is not a landscape, which is mountainous. It's a fractal. It's a mathematical shape. That is not a coastline. Again, it's just a shape drawn on a computer. That isn't a leaf. It's just a fractal. And lastly, that is not a tree. Again, it's just a computer-generated image using fractal-type programming, drawing a fractal, essentially. So, three properties of fractals found in nature. Self-similarity, we see that. A lot of complexity from relatively simple instructions. You get wonderful diversity combined with well-structured order. Now, I think the best way to understand that is going back to the Mandelbrot set. What you saw in the Mandelbrot set was, although you couldn't appreciate it, there are millions and millions and millions. In fact, I think it's an infinite number. They go on forever. Of these little snowman people. They are all different. If you looked at them properly, no two of them are the same in the Mandelbrot set. They are all different. They are all unique. But they do all look like they're part of a family. They all look like they're one of those little snowman people. Now, when God created the universe, I think one thing that he cared about was how you combine wonderful diversity with well-structured order. How you have both of those together. And I was particularly interested in how he does that in his special project. What comes now is my favourite bit of this morning. I found 15 photographs representing God's special project. Now, originally when I started off, it was really supposed to be a representative sample of the whole human race. In the end, that was far too much hard work, and it was clear I wasn't going to succeed, so all ideas on diversity and equality went out of the window. And what I went for instead was people I like the pictures of. And that was people who have character etched into their faces. What that meant was nearly all of them were old people with absolutely wonderful faces, people you'd love to meet. And inevitably, to keep some of you happy, I threw in a reasonable smattering of babies as well. So, God's special project. Number one, an old man. What a wonderful face. Number two, the first baby. The third one is another person with a lifetime of experiences behind them. The fourth one is a lady I would love to know. The fifth one is a man I would quite like to know. The sixth one is a token younger person with a lovely smile. Seventh one is a man whose life is not straightforward. The eighth one is a sleeping baby. The ninth one is a teenager. Now, I put smiling teenager into Google, and in all honesty, I didn't find anything I liked the look of. I then put moody teenager into Google. There were loads to choose from, and I chose my favourite one. It's a girl on a bench. Number 10 is another old woman with a wonderful face. Number 11 is a younger man with a big grin. And number 12 is the one that I personally would like to be. Number 13 is the one that I would like my son to be just a little bit more like. Number 14 is the perfect grandfather. And the last one, number 15, and I put a bit of effort into this one, it was the winner in the cutest baby competition. the right response. So, in summary, we believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. From time to time, all of us catch a glimpse of our creator when we look at his creation. God is a very cool creator. I don't think that's the correct theological term, but it'll have to do. In particular, there is a wonderful mix of order and diversity in his work. And lastly, there are two other creations of God that interest us. The first that interests me a great deal is not one that has happened, but the one that is yet to happen, one that's in the future, when God will create a new heaven and a new earth, using all of the creativity that he used with this creation, but ending up with something where sin has no place, where evil has no place. I don't know what it'll be like, but I'm more than happy to trust in a creator who did such a good job with his first creation. God's creation at Hebron in Carlisle. A present creation. An ongoing creation. Whilst there are many small, medium, and large things which we may well disagree about, there is one very large thing on which we all agree. Probably. We agree on who we hope will be the supervising architect. Who we hope will be the chief designer. Oop. Didn't know I'd get emotional then. Who we hope will be the creative force behind all our work. We agree on whose will we hope and pray will be done at Hebron in the months and years to come. And what I mean by that is I have my own vision of what I would like Hebron to be. I have my own dreams of what I would like Hebron to be. But I don't hope that they will be realized. My hope is that God will do what he wants to do, and that he will create what he wants to create. Ian.